reaffirming its unwavering support, the U.S. announces a new military aid package for Ukraine.
This package will help Ukrainian forces on the battlefield and support its air defenses as Russia continues to launch brutal strikes against the people of Ukraine.
Plus, extreme weather around the globe continues as a powerful hurricane is now bearing down on the U.S. state of Florida.
With Hurricane Idalia, what we're looking at is a situation where you have a hurricane, and right now in the Gulf of Mexico, the waters are very warm, and those warm waters are providing fuel, which is allowing it to strengthen very quickly.
And Afghan female commandos who've taken refuge in the U.S. are turning tragedy into triumph. Today is Wednesday, August 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. The Biden administration announced Tuesday it will send an additional $250 million worth of weapons and ammunition to Ukraine as part of its ongoing support of Kyiv's counteroffensive against Russian forces.
It includes additional mine-clearing equipment, missiles for air defense, ammunition for artillery and HIMARS systems, and over 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters Tuesday the Kremlin can end this war.
They can end it today, anytime, by withdrawing its forces from Ukraine and stopping its brutal attacks. Until it does, the United States and our allies and partners will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes.
Ukraine has already received more than $43 billion from the U.S. since Russia invaded last year. At least four people died in Ukraine on Tuesday in incidents related to Russia's 18-month invasion. A private burial was held for Yevgeny Prigozhin Tuesday, the head of the Kremlin-financed Wagner mercenary group, who died in a suspicious plane crash 2 months after his brief mutiny that challenged the authority of President Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin's death, along with those of several of his top associates who also perished in the crash, leaves a lot of unknowns about the group's activities going forward, particularly in Africa. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief Mariana Diallo reports.
It's hard to predict what's going to happen to Wagner operations in Africa after the recent death of its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, given his reach on the continent the past few years, says Stephen Grust, head of the Africa-Russia project at the South African Institute of International Affairs in Johannesburg.
There is going to be a period of uncertainty, of perhaps people jockeying for position, of seeing who wants to take over. There's also the talk of Russia incorporating it into the armies, taking it out of private hands.
But the international crisis group's Charles Boissel tells VOA the private mercenary group's activities in Africa will be disrupted because of the relationship the Wagner boss and some of his associates, including Valery Shekalov and Dmitry Utkin, who all recently died with him in a plane crash, were able to cultivate the past few years.
All these leaders, Prigozhin and Utkin especially, had like a deep knowledge, and they had all the connection with the African regime where Wagner is working, and so it will take time for Russia to take it over and to rebuild relations with these countries.
Wagner's influence stretches across the African continent, says Grust.
The Wagner presence in Africa is large, reportedly over 5,000 soldiers spread across the various countries, deeply embedded in countries like Central African Republic and Mali, less so in Libya and Sudan. Even as late as last week, it looked like Niger and Burkina Faso, you know, the country that have undergone coups, particularly in West Africa and across the Sahel, are targets for Wagner.
The U.S. Treasury Department accused the group of mass execution, rape, and physical abuse in Mali and Central African Republic, or CAR, and designated it a criminal organization. In the CAR in particular, it's too early to assess the impact Prigozhin's death will have, but it's important to remember the role the group had under its leader, says Boissel.
In the Central African Republic, signed a deal with Russia in late 2017, and this deal included the arrival of Wagner and the assistance of Wagner toward the president. Since then, Wagner was able to oust the former colonizer France out of the country and out of the decision-making part of the country, and they managed to secure Touadéra's power to make him re-elected. They managed to deter rebel groups from attacking the capital again, and they managed to weaken the these armed groups.
In the CAR, Boissel notes the group controlled businesses in the mining of gold and diamonds. They are also present in the timber industry and beverage sector. Dr. Edgar Githua, a lecturer at the United States International University in Nairobi and Strathmore University, specializing in international relations, peace and conflict, says Prigozhin's death will affect the group's finances and its global influence might take a hit because of his persona.
Prigozhin is the one who had the financial strings of the Wagner Group. He's the one who had the international connections. He's the one who would get all these international contracts. It was a one-man show. Prigozhin had a lot of power, a lot of say within that group. And with his demise, that group is going to find itself a bit rudderless for some time.
Prigozhin's death comes a couple of months after he staged an unsuccessful rebellion against top Russian military commanders. After that failed mutiny, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov indicated that operations in the CAR and Mali were not going to be affected. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Extreme weather continues across the globe. Hurricane Idalia is bearing down on the Florida Gulf Coast and bringing a dangerous storm surge. National Hurricane Center lead meteorologist David Zelinsky.
Our areas that are normally dry could be under 10 to up to 15 feet of water. So again, if you think of a person standing on the coast in an area that's normally dry, it could be up to 15 feet above ground level, especially close to where the center of the storm.
Meanwhile, a massive wildfire continued burning unabated in northeastern Greece for the 11th day Tuesday, despite the efforts of hundreds of firefighters and a fleet of water-dropping aircraft from Greece and several of its European Union partners. We're following these other stories from around the world. Taiwan's defense ministry warned on Tuesday of a possible sharp increase in military tensions after reporting renewed Chinese military activity, including fighter jets, crossing the sensitive median line of the Taiwan Strait. China claims the democratically governed Taiwan as its own territory. A global operation led by the FBI and its international partners has dismantled one of the most notorious cybercrime tools used to launch ransomware attacks and steal sensitive data. The operation disrupted the infrastructure and seized nearly $9 million in illicit cryptocurrency profits. Zimbabwe's main opposition party on Tuesday called for last week's elections to be rerun, saying the polls were riddled with flaws and calling on other African countries to help mediate in its impasse with the ruling party. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Gravitational waves are considered ripples in the fabric of space-time by the science community. The first Einstein-predicted gravitational waves were detected in 2015 by the LIGO and Virgo scientific collaborations. Scientists have now found evidence that Earth and the universe are surrounded by a background hum of ultra-low-frequency gravitational waves. The LIGO-Virgo detected waves were said to oscillate at frequencies of about 100 cycles per second. By comparison, Caltech's Katerina Chatsianu says in an email that these gravitational waves oscillate once over years or decades. This discovery was based on 15 years of multiple radio telescope observations by the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. The UN Refugee Agency is warning Niger's political crisis could rapidly deteriorate into a humanitarian crisis. The UNHCR representative in Niger says the country is experiencing repeated attacks by non-state armed groups and ECOWAS sanctions are preventing humanitarian aid from entering the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
With no political solution in sight, UN agencies are developing contingency plans for whatever emergency may arise. Since the military coup ousted the democratically elected president on July 26th, a cloud of uncertainty has hung over the country. The UN Refugee Agency's representative in Niger, Emmanuel Guignac, says violence and attacks by armed groups, especially near the Mali and Burkina Faso borders, have displaced more than 20,000 people in the last month. During the same period, he says up to 2,500 refugees refugees, mainly from Mali and Burkina Faso, and some from Nigeria, have fled as refugees into Niger. On a visit to Geneva from his post in Niamey, Guignard told journalists today that Niger's status as a hub for refugees is in jeopardy. He says recent events have heightened protection risks for refugees, asylum seekers, and their hosts.
It's also a route, a migration route, towards North Africa and Libya in particular. And we do have asylum seekers or people in need of international protection who are mixed with these movements. The borders are closed. Will these flow continue or not? If they do, they have to happen in a way that is far more underground than what they used to.
This, he says, will likely lead to more exploitation and abuse. Guignard says the threat of military intervention by ECOWAS, though seemingly unlikely, hangs in the air and must be taken seriously. He says the UNHCR is particularly concerned by ECOWAS sanctions that don't include exceptions for humanitarian relief. If sanctions are not lifted, he warns, the inability to bring sufficient humanitarian aid into the country will have a catastrophic effect.
The fact that people don't have access, as they used to have, to food commodities and the scarcity of goods in general will lead to a number of protection risks that will develop. You know, we're talking about early marriage, sexual violence, trafficking, and exploitation.
He says the UNHCR has a well-developed monitoring system that tracks incidents of abuse. In July, he says there were 255 protection incidents, including kidnappings, gender-based violence, and domestic violence in Niger. He says this data is in line with the rest of the year. However, he says UNHCR teams have witnessed a sharp 50% increase in the number of incidents between July 26th and July 31st over previous weeks in July. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Historic rivals Greece and Turkey are stepping up efforts to improve ties after the two countries' leaders received strong election mandates this year. Next week, Turkish and Greek foreign ministers are scheduled to meet in Turkey, but analysts warn substantial obstacles remain between the neighbors. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Greek Foreign Minister Yorgos Garapatritis is scheduled to meet his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan on September the 5th in the latest rapprochement effort between the historic rivals. Analysts say Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis' landslide election victory in June is allowing him to pursue his long-term goal of rapprochement. Alexis Heraklidis of Athens Pantheon University in Athens.
I wouldn't call it his secret agenda, but he did want the amelioration of relations, and that's something that goes back since the beginning of this century when I first met him. The fact that he was able to get this victory sort of unties his hands. Previously, he was tied by, he had little leeway.
Mitsotakis used his new mandate to replace Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, after his re-election in May, also replaced his Foreign Minister with Fidan, widely regarded as a skilled diplomat. Some analysts say with the elections behind him, the Turkish president is in a position to tone down his nationalist rhetoric, which is popular with his electoral base, and be receptive to Greek overtures. Hüseyin Bağcı is the head of the Foreign Policy Institute, an Ankara-based research organization.
The new government, of course, will be much more cooperative. I think the issues, non-solvable issues, will continue, but rhetoric will be much more slow-down rhetoric.
The Aegean and Mediterranean seas remain flashpoints for the Greek and Turkish navies, as both countries search for what are believed to be large energy reserves in disputed waters. At the same time, the island of Cyprus, divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriot communities, continues to be a potential point of tension. Analysts say an improvement in bilateral ties could remove an obstacle to the sale of American military jets to Turkey. The sale has been delayed in part over Washington's concern about tensions between the two NATO allies. But given the history of failed attempts, observers question how long the efforts by Turkey and Greece to improve ties will last. Mediterranean security analyst Aya Buwela.
You see these wonderful pictures coming out. Everybody's like, smiley, nice photo op. I think in 3 months, 6 months, we'll see if people are going to go back to their baseline. It's like in a horrible marriage. There's a little honeymoon period and then everybody goes back to who they really are.
Hopeful some signs include Greek and Turkish leaders' decisions to refrain from angry rhetoric after incidents like the recent flare-up of tensions in Cyprus over the construction of a road in contested territory and the announcement of new Turkish drilling for energy sources in the Mediterranean. Mitsotakis and Erdogan are expected to meet on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in October, and let's say the two leaders aim to hold a summit later this year in Greece. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
2 years ago, when the Taliban retook control of Kabul, Afghanistan's only unit of female commandos were left with a target on their backs. A group of U.S. military women helped evacuate nearly 40 of those Afghan commandos. Today, as their legal status remains in limbo, a group called Command Purpose is using art to help release the trauma of the past while supporting their futures. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has their story.
In the small town of Buda, Texas, these women are creating something new using pieces from their past.
This transformative process of turning clothing into paper, usually people don't believe it, you know, and so it's this magical process that they get to be part of, and I always say it's kind of like alchemy.
Military uniforms, hats, headscarves, cut up, washed, and pulverized into a pulp. Pulp that's either pressed into paper or used to make these paintings.
It's about releasing that pain. It's about liberating and through connection, building something beautiful from something that was traumatic.
It's called Project Raha, after the Dari word for release. The Afghans here served in the Afghan National Army's female tactical platoon, deploying with American special forces to collect intelligence in areas men couldn't. Some of these women even served together in Afghanistan, that is, until the Taliban took over 2 years ago this month.
That whole evacuation was, I mean, it was a mess. I think a lot of us felt really helpless. Like, it felt like something that was so close to our hearts, a culture and people that we loved and cared about. We were watching things just fall apart in a matter of days and hours.
Army veteran Sarah Scully worked with the female tactical platoon from 2019 to 2020 when Kabul fell. She and other military women helped get their Afghan counterparts out of the country. It's a time that's painful for the command to talk about.
We lost our dream. We lost our goals. We lost everything. Everything was like changed in one day. Everything.
After 2 years, almost all of the nearly 40 female commandos who came to the United States remain in legal limbo, stuck in a backlog of asylum applicants.
They're from a country that being a woman in the military was like putting a target on your back. And the fact that some of these women still do not have asylum and some of them still have their futures up in the air and there's a big question mark of what's next is an injustice.
Hassani says she wants to know that she and her family will be safe away from the Taliban's reach. She spent her whole life wanting to be in the Afghan military, a dream the Taliban took away. She now wants to join the U.S. Army, but she can't without a green card.
I know I'm losing the time. If I get older, I couldn't join to army and couldn't to follow my childhood dream.
Piece by piece, they place their loss, love, and hope onto canvas. The veteran support group Command Purpose will display their work in a New York art gallery in November to raise money and awareness. Hassani's favorite piece that she created is a tribute to the Afghan army and Afghan flag.
Afghanistan is everything. Afghanistan is my heart.
Trauma transformed, old made new, one art piece at a time. Carla Babb, VOA News.
As the tech industry rushes to unlock the potential of artificial intelligence, AI hackathons, day-long collaborations using the technology to tackle real-world problems, are increasing in popularity. From the state of Washington, Natasha Moskovaya reports.
On a Saturday morning in August, dozens of people of different ages and programming skills gather at Microsoft's Reactor building in Redmond, Washington, to test the possibilities of artificial intelligence. Their goal for this AI camp hackathon is to come up with an application addressing a real-world problem by the end of the day.
Right now, our idea is build a bot who can generate a storyline along with images.
Xiaoshan Li, a software developer, is attending this sort of event for the first time.
I just want to learn about the large language model because I have been heard people talking about that, but I don't know. I know nothing about it. I hope the AI stuff can take my job someday so it can relieve me for other interesting things.
Some participants came alone to recruit volunteers to work on their idea. Others came in groups. This team of data science students from Seattle University came up with a tool that detects cyberbullying online.
It was intimidating, but it was also pretty fun. Yeah, like we actually managed to complete it. Yeah.
And we were really impressed that we managed to complete it because we start everything today.
Bill Liu, former Microsoft and Amazon engineer and founder of AI Camp, says there is a spike of interest in the topic from different industries.
We started this AI hackathon event to streamline the process to bring those smart ideas, smart minds together. The teams own their code, own their project, and as the AI Camp, we only provide the platform for them to expose to the investors, expose to other talents.
To make the pressing deadline requires plenty of coffee and whiteboarding, and it's not just for fun.
The AI has made many, many tools newly available, and it's made it easier to use them, and so it's enabled people to build more and more complex hackathon projects. And it's gotten to the point where, you know, now in Seattle, we're hosting these hackathons with some incubators, some accelerators, some venture capitalists, where we're saying, like, hey, like, people at this hackathon could build a real project that you may actually want to fund, and this project may turn into a real product.
Adia Goyal, a high school sophomore, was on a team that created an application to help customers make sense of insurance documents.
This hackathon, it showed me, like, the true potential of AI. Like, there were so many good projects today that, like, it showed me what AI could be. Like, I would have never thought that it could be used in so many different ways. It gave me a taste of what my future is going to look like, and it's so nice.
Not all participants were eager to bet their career on AI, but all agreed the rapid changes in the industry seem less intimidating with some hands-on experience. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Redmond, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent UN Security Council briefing on the DPRK and nonproliferation, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, excoriated Russia and the PRC for refusing to condemn the DPRK's latest attempt to launch a satellite into space using ballistic missile technology. The August 23rd launch, though a failure, was another violation of UN Security Council resolutions and another threat to the DPRK's neighbors and the world, Ambassador Thomas Greenfield said.
The vast majority of council members have affirmed their opposition to the DPRK's unlawful actions and have called for council unity to address them. This should be an issue that unifies us. We have all reaffirmed our commitment to the global nonproliferation regime time and time again. But since the beginning of 2022, this council has failed to live up to its commitments because of China and Russia's obstructionism.
The entire Security Council used to stand up and speak with one voice against the DPRK's unlawful actions, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But in July, Russian and Chinese officials traveled to Pyongyang for a celebration of the regime's ballistic missile advancements.
The DPRK's nuclear threat is growing, and Russia and China are not living up to their responsibility to maintain international peace and security. Instead, they are celebrating violations of Security Council resolutions and continuing to block Council action.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield rejected the disingenuous claims of Russia and China that the United States is acting in a hostile manner toward the DPRK. She noted the U.S. allied military exercises that have taken place this year are routine, lawful, and defensive in nature. She also reiterated that the United States remains committed to diplomacy.
publicly and privately at senior levels, we have repeatedly urged the DPRK to engage in dialogue. We have made clear we have no preconditions for engagement and are prepared to discuss any topic of concern, but the DPRK still not responded to our offers.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield urged her colleagues on the Security Council to collectively and unequivocally denounce the DPRK's unlawful behavior. Division only empowers the DPRK, she declared. So let us work together once again to confront this pressing threat to international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.